and welcome back to AASA, the School Superintendent Association's Public Education Policy Podcast, or PEP Talk for short. I am Kat Sturdivant. I am the Advocacy and Governance Coordinator and your producer at the top of each episode. On this episode, with everything going on in the student and child privacy space lately, we invited Amelia Vance, Chief Counsel, and Morgan Lefwich, our Project Director, at our in-house Student and Child Privacy Center here at AASA. This episode was so rich and informative for superintendents who want to stay on top of legislation and current events in this space. So without further ado, let's get to the episode.
Hello, and welcome back to PEP Talk, AASA's Public Education Policy Podcast. This week, we're excited to dive into the increasingly frenetic world of student and child privacy laws. And to do that, we've invited a couple of members of our Student and Child Privacy Project, our Chief Counsel, Amelia Vance, and our Project Director, Morgan Lefwich. Welcome, ladies. I'm going to have us dive right into the content that we want to discuss today. Let's do a warm-up question. I'll let you decide which order you want to go in, but here's the first thing I want to ask. To someone unfamiliar with student and child privacy law, how would you describe what student privacy is and why superintendents should be engaged on this topic?
We need to start defining privacy by defining the last question you asked, why this matters in the first place. And a lot of it is because education is built around uses must-have data in order to work. So schools collect data from students, teachers, parents, directly or indirectly. Schools use data to determine eligibility for services, provide services, personalize learning, and measure student achievement. Schools protect data with people policies, federal and state privacy laws, tools and training. And schools also share data with individual employees in the building, but also with third parties in order to provide services that they could not deliver themselves, as well as through required state reporting. So because data is surrounding so much of education, the privacy and security of that data is vitally important. And so when I define student data privacy, I usually talk about it as the responsible, ethical, and equitable collection, use, sharing, and protection of student data. It's fundamental to education and fundamental to the protection of the students that superintendents serve.
Morgan, would you add anything there?
Yes. So that was a phenomenal answer. And if you ask 10 people what privacy means, you're probably going to get 10 different answers. I would say that student and child privacy is about protecting the personal information of young people who may not be able to do so themselves. So student privacy protections establish rules for keeping student data safe while still allowing schools to collect and process data so they can continue to function effectively. And to go back to your question on why superintendents should be engaged on this topic, on the surface, superintendents should be aware of their district's child privacy obligations because it's the law and there can be major obligations for noncompliance. But on a deeper level than that, superintendents should care about student privacy because they want what is best for their students. Students' lives can be changed forever if their personal information is improperly disclosed. It's a school administrator's ethical responsibility to be engaged in student privacy and ensure that student information is protected too.
Well, I think you've both demonstrated why we invited you here today. Listening to your responses, though, something that really sticks out to me is taking a moment right now to state the obvious. Student and child data and privacy is pervasive. It's in every element of the instruction and learning and student experience that our students have in schools daily. I think what warrants clarification, though, is that you really only hear about student data and privacy when it goes wrong. So I think it's important to level set that when it goes wrong, it can go wrong. And to Morgan's comments, it can have very detrimental and lasting impacts on students and impacted staff. Far more often, it is going right, but we're here to talk about that broader environment of all the things that need to be considered. So with that level setting, I want to dig right into the next question, Morgan. And it actually builds on a little bit of that obligation point that you concluded your previous response with. What's the legal landscape of student and child privacy law looking like now? And what major laws come into play? And how is this landscape changing over time? I put in the clarification that here at AASA, we focus on federal policy, but the work of the Student and Child Privacy Center that Amelia and Morgan are leading includes support and analysis of federal and state law. Morgan?
Yes. So at the federal level, some of the major student and child privacy laws include the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, and the Protection of People Rights Amendment, PPRA. Many states have passed their own child and student privacy laws too, so always check the specific rules in your state. As a whole, there's been a lot of movement in student and child privacy recently, and we expect the legal landscape will continue to evolve over the next couple of years. Right now, we're watching several bills, including the Kids Online Safety Act, the Children and Teens Online Privacy Protection Act, and the Parents' Bill of Rights Act. We're also waiting to see if and when a new round of FERPA rulemaking will take place. In general, policymakers have been especially interested in topics like social media and youth mental health, parental rights, and protecting children online. And it will be interesting to see how this focus shapes new legislation.
Amelia, do you have anything you want to add when it comes to the legislative landscape, what we're looking at here?
I think, as Morgan said, the biggest ways that we're seeing student privacy show up in the landscape right now is through a focus on child privacy. How do we best protect kids from social media or other potential dangers or risks of the internet? How do we make sure that kids aren't exposed to inappropriate content, that we're trying to do everything we can to protect their mental health, that we help them recover from, obviously, the after effects of the pandemic and everything else? And so this is showing up across the country, largely in laws that don't mention schools. But of course, since kids spend the vast majority of their time in school, at least waking hours, and also spend a lot of time on devices on the internet at school in order to help them to personalize learning, to just help schools run more efficiently and effectively, that means that schools are a vital player in these conversations, that school districts need to be looped in. And a lot of the legislation that we've seen, as I said, doesn't mention education at all.
Well, you and I have an odd sense of fun, but we had fun last December boxing out on bills at the federal level around student child privacy that sounded like things we should outright endorse: Kids Online Safety Act, Child Online Privacy Protection Act. But for reasons that we'd be happy to get into on another episode, the specifics really were disruptive to the operations of a school system. And it's that forward thinking effort. Just a little bit of time can go a long ways toward making some of these legislative proposals much more functional. And at the end of that implementation timeline, meaningful and better acting for students for a more positive experience. So if I take what you were just talking about, Amelia, what are some of those safeguards that should be considered? What are the safeguards that you urge lawmakers to incorporate when they're drafting these child privacy bills?
Certainly from a school perspective, the number one thing is making sure that education stakeholders are in the room and making sure that they are weighing in on these different protections for children, which will ultimately come down to the protections they also may have as students. And making sure that we are, in fact, protecting kids and not just passing something that says we're protecting kids. Educators are vital stakeholders at the table in these conversations. So, I mean, that's first and foremost as legislators at the federal and state levels are working on this. But in addition to that, let's be clear, laws do need to be passed here. There need to be better protections for kids online, offline too, but primarily right now online, and their information. We need to make sure that that information isn't exploited by for-profit companies, that it is kept safe, that vendors are keeping the promises that they are making to schools about the security and privacy of their products. And so we definitely support improvements in order to in order to actually make sure we're meeting those goals. But again, that needs to start with having the education stakeholders at the table in the first place. And so making sure that policymakers keep that in mind and are also thinking about the protections that should apply in every aspect of kids' lives, from being at home to being at school, being at a friend's house. Like, what are all of the different situations that come up in kids' day-to-day lives? So we actually make sure that these protections work.
So, Amelia, we've been geeking out on this policy and student child privacy stuff for the better part of a decade as colleagues and peers. And something that you said pretty consistently that resonates with me is still, as much as the technology advances, as much as we've seen a lot of really good policy at the state level, and we're starting to see that bubble up to the federal level, so much of what the risk is still relies at the hands of humans. It's human error, overwhelmingly unintentional. But I think that warrants an emphasis on the importance of both having those education stakeholders at the table and understanding that the investment is not just in the technology. It's in the support of the humans who are interacting with and generating the data and inputting and accessing. And I'm not sure if I summarized what you said to me correctly, but that's how I've internalized it. And it's definitely part of what I hear from the superintendents. Would you clarify anything there?
I absolutely agree. The laws that we've seen be most successful on student privacy and protecting student privacy have been the ones that come with funding and training requirements, because human error really is the number one way that information ends up being disclosed. It's usually not a hacker trying to do bad things. It's often sharing information accidentally in an email that you didn't mean to send, or having information unsecured, or other just basic day-to-day things. And let's be clear, the people who have access to that information who may be accidentally sharing it generally need it. You don't want to say, oh, only the principal in the school can access student information or something. Education needs various stakeholders having access to information to improve education for individual kids. And so we need to make sure that we are providing that access and minimizing the possible mistakes that can be made, both through training, through technological measures, but making sure that that isn't an unfunded mandate that we're just throwing on top of our bloodborne pathogens training and everything else that teachers are going through as they restart school.
One of my random fun memories, I think this is about 5 years ago, we were in with the House Republican Committee staff, Amelia, and remember they wanted to have fines assessed with noncompliance. And the negotiation we were trying to engage on was, if there are going to be fines, which we opposed, but they were going to have them, we were trying to redirect and ensure that any fines collected automatically went only to professional development. Because we're like, if there's going to be fines assessed, it has to pay for this professional development. Do you remember that negotiation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the funny things we've seen in federal legislation is this idea that, oh, FERPA has no teeth. There's, you know, nothing we can do right now. And so if we have big fines, if we have other things, you know, this'll fix stuff. And as I said, so much of this is information that is accidentally shared. So first of all, deterrence through some bigger fine or effect isn't necessarily going to make a difference. But also, the thing most people don't know about FERPA that would carry over into any amendment to FERPA is that school districts have the opportunity to fix things, because we don't want to take money out of the pockets of kids. And let's be clear, it's taking the money out of the pockets of kids, not, you know, some amorphous district entity. If we are fining a district, we are taking that money from the education of kids. And so federally, statewide, I think everybody wants to give districts an opportunity to fix when there is something that goes wrong. And so even if you had lower fines, I think you'd have the exact same number of FERPA enforcement actions, because if somebody calls up a superintendent and says, hey, someone in your district is violating FERPA, you better believe that they're going to respond very quickly to try and fix whatever it is, regardless of whether it's fines or the current environment. And so we have to be careful that in any laws that are proposed, we're making sure that it'll fix the problems that we want to solve and not just make us feel better because now we have fines.
Let the record reflect that from an AASA policy perspective, fines are not the fix as we talk about this. I had a memory and it took us on a tangent and I just want to clarify. So as we are entering these or continuing these negotiations, actually fines aren't part of any of the conversations right now. I should give credit where credit is due to House and Senate Republicans and Democrats. And I'd like to get us back on track with some of the things we wanted to talk about. I want to start with Morgan and ask you to ID what you think some of the top student privacy concerns for schools are going to be this year. And that could include legislation, but it might be other considerations as well. Morgan and then Amelia.
A couple student privacy concerns that stand out for me in particular are related to technology. So a major one this school year will be how emerging technologies like AI is incorporated in the school environment and how to make sure that students and teachers both understand the privacy risks and potential harms associated with emerging technologies. In addition to this, schools should be thinking about how they use edtech, like deciding what platforms to use, when parental consent is needed, and what provisions need to go into contracts with edtech providers. There's also an ongoing concern around schools being the target of data breaches and other cyber incidents.
Amelia, what would you add to that list?
I think that was pretty comprehensive. Just noting that a lot of the bills and policies around parental rights or parental input into curriculum end up having some implications on the student privacy side and the tech side, because of course, so much of our curriculum these days has a root or has some sort of technological tool associated with it. EdTech in many ways is the new textbook. And so when we are talking about parental input or insight into technology, curriculum, we're often talking about input into technology and maybe some restrictions on what can be used and what parents need to consent to and other things. And so I know districts are paying close attention to a lot of those state and federal proposals or implementing some of the proposals that recently passed. But I'd urge them to take a look at the possible privacy implications and how it may change how they adopt or use tech in their district.
I think that's a good quick starting space. And I think as the superintendents or anyone listening to this podcast reflects on what you just said were things they should consider, I think the additional thing that warrants a spot on their radar is that you might not even know what it is you need to pay attention to. As we look at how much cybersecurity and AI are entering this space, at different times we've seen those as very siloed conversations. But I think when you look at how data-driven AI and cyber are, these data privacy concerns for students are going to be very, very pervasive. And so it's just best to be nimble. And whatever that phrase is, and a ounce of prevention is worth a pound of pain or whatever it is, however you can prevent it. I think that that's something to keep at the forefront of your mind as you navigate this. I want to do a sharp 180 degree turn to something that we've started paying attention to in May. And this is one of those issues that wasn't super high profile, but was potentially high impact. And I'm talking about the May decision coming out of the Federal Trade Commission, where they announced a $6 million settlement against ed tech provider Edmodo, in which they alleged that the company violated COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Rule, and unlawfully used children's personal information for advertising and outsourced compliance to school districts. At AASA, we didn't really take a position on the settlement. We had some back and forth with the FTC and the Department of Ed to ensure that the experience of districts with providers will remain seamless and uninterrupted, and we have those assurances. But on a more technical level, Amelia, what are some of the takeaways for superintendents from this Edmodo settlement, and how will that trickle over into their day-to-day experience?
So the Edmodo settlement definitely reflected one of the things we were talking about earlier, which is you have a lot of things that happen without schools being in the room. And in this particular case, there were a couple things in the Edmodo settlement where it was like, I don't think districts work the way that this appears to think they work. So I think it just really illustrates that point. However, there's actually something that could help districts a great deal in this settlement that I definitely want to highlight. So the whole point of this was Edmodo was collecting more information than they needed to. They weren't really giving schools the control that they needed to give them. And so the way that settlements work is that while these settlements are binding only on the company that is entering into the settlement, they're essentially used kind of like court cases as jurisprudence. Any settlement is used as the standard that all edtech companies would need to meet moving forward. And so the really useful things for districts here is that the FTC said that there is a requirement. Edmodo is permanently restrained and enjoined from relying on schools to act as intermediaries to obtain verifiable parental consent. Basically, companies can't pass their COPPA obligations onto schools. And it says that they can only rely on school authorization, so schools consenting to the use of tech instead of parents consenting to the use of tech, when there is a written agreement with the school or a school employee who is authorized to enter into an agreement on behalf of the school. And that written agreement has to say that personal information can only be used for educational purposes. It has to describe all personal information that's collected and how it will be used and disclosed. Provide the school a link to its online notice of information practices and recommends to the school that they make it available on the school's website. It requires that the school staff are signing, acknowledge and agree they have the authority to authorize collection of personal information from children on behalf of the school. That's a big one because it means that teachers probably can't independently consent anymore. And it requires that any personal information collected by the defendant, by the edtech company, is under the direct control of the school with regard to its use and maintenance. Basically, this is a new tool that districts can use to push companies to have better provisions in their contracts. So there's a number of districts who I've talked to over the years who have said, what can we do when, you know, these big companies are much bigger and have much more money and more lawyers than we do. How do we make them fulfill the legal requirements that we have under FERPA? There was some help as states passed laws that put direct requirements on companies to protect student privacy, to have certain provisions in those agreements. Only about 30 states have those. This settlement probably means that all edtech companies now need to enter into that written agreement, and that written agreement has to include all of that different information. And so superintendents and others can point at it and say, hey, you're required to do this. This is a legal requirement for you. Let's see it. Show me each element of the written agreement where this happens. So it can be very useful in just giving superintendents another tool that they can use to make sure companies are doing the right thing.
Take that kind of cascading waterfall effect from Edmodo that isn't necessarily disruptive, but is something for them to pay attention to and see how that plays out over the year. We've come to the point in our episode today where we're at the last question, and I'm happy to see that this is something we want both of you to speak to. When it comes to student privacy, it's absolutely something that feels like you have to be an expert in FERPA and how all of these complex laws fit together to comply with the law. What advice do you have superintendents or district administrators who want to protect student privacy but may have trouble navigating this complicated, shifting, and multifaceted legal landscape?
This is definitely something where you can lean on ASA's expertise, the Student and Child Privacy Center. We're here to help. We're lucky. It's been about 10 years since student privacy took off as an issue in states, and there were very few resources at the time. We have well over probably 500, 800 by now, many of which break down these obligations in much simpler and clearer ways. And of course, you know, a lot of these general legal obligations are useless to talk about unless we're talking about them in the context of your day-to-day job. And a lot of these resources actually do that. They break down, okay, what are you doing in the special education context, in the context of the school counselor, in the context of sharing data for federal reporting? So reach out. There's a lot of amazing resources here that we can share to help you do things a little more easily and mean that you don't have to go back and look at the law and call your lawyer every time you want to do basic data sharing or another basic aspect of running a district.
Morgan, you want to take us home?
Absolutely. I would reiterate everything Amelia just said. She summed it up beautifully. It is difficult. There's a lot of information. It can be very hard to navigate on your own. But just remember that you don't have to do this alone. It's important that you're engaged on the topic and open to learning more. There are tons of free resources online that can be a great starting point. But there are also people like Amelia and I who spend a ton of time learning about this area of the law and working to figure out some of the more complicated issues. So if you have questions, be empowered to start looking for those answers and always feel free to reach out to experts working in this area for some help.
And I think that's a great note to end on. One of the things that we like to highlight at AASA as a member organization is that your membership comes with benefits. And that includes the advocacy of our department and through the Student and Child Privacy Center that Morgan and Amelia are running with our colleague, Catherine. The resources that are available through that are for you. So never hesitate to reach out directly to us to let us know what you're looking for so we can either send you what we already have or get to work on creating something that would be helpful. So I'd like to just take a moment to say thank you for taking some time out of your day to listening to this episode of Pep Talk. I'd like to extend my gratitude to my colleagues, Amelia and Morgan, for joining me in this conversation. Appreciation, as always, for our driving force behind the scenes, Kat Sturdivant, for the work to develop and produce our podcast, and encourage you to keep listening and never hesitate to drop recommendations on topics, guests, or other ideas that you'd like us to consider. Thank you, and that concludes today's episode.
And that's a wrap on this episode of AASA's Pep Talk Podcast. We invite you to share it by using the hashtag PepTalk on Twitter. You can access past episodes in the Pep Talk library by visiting aasapeptalk.podbean.com. And once again, thank you for joining us.